It is Friday, February 8th, 2008. Sam Cedar in for the great Mike Malloy. Hello, Truth Seekers. It's casual Friday around these parts. We're going to be very casual, your calls today. A lot to talk about. The torture train rolls on. Michael Mukasey been on the Hill this week, basically saying, torture, you know, look, who can tell really whether or not it's legal and... You know, we may have deemed it legal. Let's not talk. Can't we move on to something like porno or something? We'll be talking to the great Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine. He'll give us an update on the torture policy, what's going on with the FISA bill as it winds its way through the Senate. They're anticipating the big vote on the FISA bill in the Senate anyways. That includes... a retroactive immunity for telecommunications companies that spied on you illegally. Some of these weak-kneed Democrats, Jell-O J. Rockefeller, pushing this through. Complete coincidence that he gets thousands upon thousands of dollars from the telecommunications industry, providing them with this retroactive immunity. We will talk more about that. Mukasey also says, apparently, not so interested in serving those contempt of Congress citations to those Bush cronies in the firing the corruption of the Department of Justice. So as the train rolls on, Michael Mukasey, maybe not so independent. Maybe forgetting that he's actually working for the American people. He's not George Bush's private attorney as a U.S. Attorney General. We also have a lot of craziness coming out of CPAC. This is the Conservative Political Action Committee. This is where basically every nut job in the country gather to feed off each other's insanity. And we actually have a mole who has been writing about what's going on there. It's just sheer insanity. His name's Leonard Pierce. He's a freelance writer. He's a blogger for SadlyKnow.com. He's been reporting for SadlyKnow.com on the goings-ons there. We'll be talking to him later in the program. And then in this hour, we're going to be talking to Alan Raymond. He's the author of How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. Should be relatively interesting. See how much remorse this guy has. And to give us a little insight into the Republican brain, such as it is. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, the primaries still in full effect on the Democratic side. John McCabe, the pander bear, heading to CPAC I guess it was yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yesterday, basically bowing down. And they hate him. They really hate him there, but he will be their nominee. And if you're interested in more wars, folks, and probably less jobs, John McCain's your man. Remember, this is the original neocon. When he was running in 2000, Bill Kristol, one of the premier neocons, was backing John McCain because he felt that at the time... You know, this is before he knew that he'd get an insurance policy with Dick Cheney. He thought that George Bush just didn't have it in him to wage constant war. So John McCain promising a platform of more war, less jobs is now at least the presumptive Republican nominee. Mitt Romney has left. Huckabee's sticking around there with the hopes that he can... He can, I guess, work his way onto this ticket. And over the weekend, the Dems are going to be involved in a, let's see, we got two caucuses and one primary, a caucus in Washington State, primary in Louisiana, caucus in Nebraska, and then I guess on Sunday, a caucus in Maine. That'll be followed up by primaries in Virginia and Maryland next week. So it is still neck and neck in the Democratic primary. It's casual Friday, folks. If you want to call in and you want to make a case for your candidate, by all means, let the games begin. If you want to advocate for Clinton or Obama, or you want to tell me you're writing in Mike Revelle's name, or I guess he's still on the ballot in some places, glad to have that conversation. Of course, I welcome conservative callers as well. So if any conservatives out there want to call in and cry about John McCain, feel free. And if there's any people out there who actually will support John McCain, it seems like the Republicans just aren't showing up. Super Tuesday, I think Democrats outpolled Republicans, something like 14 million to 8 million, nearly doubling. Republicans just are, I mean, what? Frankly, I'm just shocked that there's still 8 million people out there who want a third Bush term. It really boggles the mind. Meanwhile, the stimulus plan passed last night in the Senate. Turns out to be a relatively crappy bill as far as I'm concerned. We will dig into that. But apparently an AP Ipsos poll shows that, people aren't going to use those tiny rebate checks they get to go out and buy anything, which is supposedly the point of a stimulus package. Half of them said they'd use it just to pay bills. Only 20% said that they would go out and actually spend the money to buy things. I don't know what you can buy for $600. Maybe you can get a dishwasher, I guess. But 50% said that a pullout from Iraq would help fix the country's economic problems a great deal. And then another 20% said that they would find it somewhat helpful. So the writing's on the wall there. The American public is sick of this occupation in Iraq. It's a shame that the, I don't know if this is the primary reason why people want to get out of Iraq, something to the effect of us having killed 300 to 600,000, maybe a million Iraqis, displaced 4 million of them, and the fact that we aren't doing anything there. We're losing American military personnel, but we're not helping any reconciliation there, and the news coming out of Iraq is starting to get bad again, folks. I know it hasn't been in the news that much because the violence had been tamped down all the way back to 2005 levels. But we know what happened in 2006, don't we? And what happened in 2007, which was the worst year for violence in the 4 years, now going on 5 years of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. So we'll dig into that. And this is just one more twist on the waterboarding, the torture that this country now embraces as a policy. The Wall Street Journal reports the CIA secret interrogation program, you can read that as torture program, has made extensive use of outside contractors, whose role likely included the waterboarding of terrorist suspects, according to testimony. This was from yesterday, from the CIA director and two other people familiar with the program. Some of these are from large mercenary companies. Some are just hired mercenaries to do some of the torture. Meanwhile, General Hayden said yesterday, in my own view, the view of the lawyer, my lawyers in the Department of Justice, it's not certain that the technique would be considered to be lawful under current statute. It's not certain, which gives a little wiggle room there. Basically, what he's answered is, we don't know. We can't really tell if it's illegal, even though this country had already, back in World War II, prosecuted Japanese soldiers for waterboarding. Hayden maintained that the practice was legal at the time the CIA used it, from 2002 to 2003, on three al-Qaeda suspects, quote, all the techniques that we've used have been deemed to be lawful. I got to talk to Scott Horton about this, because it seems to me that legality is determined by a judge, not by a lawyer writing an opinion. unless we've changed our system of law, or maybe it's just, maybe I'm just forgetting that we're talking about the Bush administration, but there is no law. All right, we've got to take a break. The number is 800-989-1480. We'll take your calls at 16 after the hour.
You can see the men who left their families behind to burn neath the sun, to be tortured and killed, where their stomachs are empty and their spirits are grilled. If you're looking for freedom, this is the price you must pay. It's written in blood on Guantanamo Bay.
Sam Cedar in from Mike Malloy. It's 21 after the hour, 800-989-1480 on Nova M Radio. George Bush at the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Just, man, there is a lot of insanity there. George Bush says, my energy is up. My spirit is high. I will finish strong. And in the meantime, we will elect a new president. Well, I guess that's encouraging, folks, that he intends to allow the election, at least now at this point, he's intending to allow the election to go forward. We've had good debates, and soon we'll have a nominee who will carry a conservative banner into this election and beyond. Listen, the stakes in November are high. This is an important election. Prosperity and peace are in the balance. Are they going to run on a prosperity and peace platform? Are you kidding me? We've got 150,000. George Exnay on the peace and prosperity. We might not want to mention those two things. Are you kidding me? This guy's, they've got to up his Halidol or whatever they've got him on. They better increase his dose. He may not even know what year it is. Sweet Lord, prosperity and peace are in the balance. You got John McCain just 4 days ago saying there's going to be more wars. And when he was in Michigan saying jobs are gone, they're not coming back. I don't know anything about economics. I don't know, maybe George Bush is signaling something to these people like, you don't want to vote for John McCain. Let's face it, folks, the time is not now for a Republican. Unbelievable. Let's go to the phones. Tracy on Sirius Radio, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Welcome to the program, Tracy.
How you doing, sir?
Good, how you doing?
Just right. I'm retired military 20 years, and I just want to say that George Bush has destroyed the Republican Party.
You know, it's not just George Bush. I mean, it's been the 12 years of Republican control of the Congress and their unilateral control of the Senate and the Congress and the presidency. George Bush led them down the path, but they all, like lemmings, followed him.
Yes, but after 9/11, the Republican Party was somewhat galvanized by that tragedy. But his bad policies over the years, now the policy, and I enjoy listening to Rush and Shine now because the party is just so disrupt. I just sit back and laugh at them. They don't know where to go now.
I got to tell you, you've got something there. To listen to Sean Hannity, and all they're doing is talking about, they're basically spend the entire program filleting Ronald Reagan as if he was some type of demigod, ignoring everything that they hated about his policies that they hate now in John McCain, because they realize there's no future for them.
As exactly right, and I'm glad that they're seeing that their policies have destroyed this party, and I'm just sitting back watching what the Republicans are going to do now. They have nowhere to turn.
nowhere to turn. I think you're absolutely right, Tracy. I appreciate the phone call. Although I got to tell you, I think what the plan is for these conservatives, I think they basically just want, they're going to ride it out with McCain. He's going to lose. And they're going to say it's because he wasn't conservative enough. And then the party is actually going to take themselves from the margin of American thought to off the page. They're going to fall off the desk. Never mind living out in the margin. They're just going to fall off the page. Let's go to Steve in Miami, Florida, listening on WINZ. Welcome to the Mike Malloy Show, Steve.
Yes, my name's Steven, by the way.
Oh, sorry, Steven.
Sam, two quick reasons why I'm calling. Wanted to say that it's time already, not to wait until after the convention, but before the convention, for the Democrats to come together and start fighting with each other and providing the Republicans material that they may want to use again in the fall. In other words, the Democrats need to be united. But the other reason I'm calling, Sam, is this is not just for me and you, but also for the audience. They need to become familiar with a 1976 movie called Voyage of the Damned. It's based on a novel that's based on a true story. It's about the, let me get it right here, it's about the Hamburg America liner, SS St. Louis, that wasn't allowed to come to either Cuba or America or any other country. It was carrying about 1,937 passengers back in 1939 from Nazi Germany. These were German Jews that were trying to escape Germany back then, and they weren't allowed to come ashore anywhere, and they had to go back to Germany. It was because of incidents like that that we have a situation today which led to the formation of Israel. In other words, Jews need to have a homeland, as you know, where they can feel safe. And
yeah, all right. Well, Stephen, listen, I'm up against the break here. I appreciate the point. Voyage of the Damned, and thank you for the call. But I'll tell you, I don't think Democrats are fighting anything other than this is a primary. This is what primary is about. I don't see the Democrats fighting over policy or breaking up over it's just different people have a different idea who's going to carry the banner for the Democrats better between these two. Frankly, I'm not enthralled with either one of them, but I think they're both good. We'll talk more about it later. Coming up next, Alan Raymond, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative, 27 after. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for the great Mike Malloy on Novam Radio. It's 34 past the hour. The number is 800-989-1480. The Sammy Cam is in effect at samcedarshow.com. On the phone right now, Alan Raymond. He was an operative of the Republican National Committee until he was convicted of illegally phone jamming New Hampshire Democratic Party offices on Election Day in 2002. After his jail sentence, he and co-author Ian Spiegelman wrote the book How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So tell me, how do you rig an election?
Well, what we did in New Hampshire, let's start there, was I was hired by the New Hampshire Republican State Committee to shut down the Democratic phone bank in Manchester, New Hampshire on Election Day in 2002. So this was the phone bank that they were staffing with volunteers to call people to remind them to vote, answer the phones when people called it about where they could vote, when the polls closed, that type of information. And what we did was we shut it down so that no calls could go out or come in. And so it was shut. Now, our operation was shut down after an hour and a half because the client got nervous. But that's one way to do it.
So it was basically you were involved in some rather intense attempts at voter suppression.
Right. I mean, this example was originally designed as to disrupt lines of communication. But, I mean, anything, you know, you can say anything that happens on election day that's sponsored by a political party is designed to get out the vote, because that's what parties do on election day. They try and win by getting more votes than the other guy.
Now, so what are other ways? Now, was that the only instance of you ever being involved in rigging an election?
Well, I give a lot of examples in the book, and the reason I wrote the book was there's a famous quote by Justice Brandeis, and that is that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is give the reader some examples of how elections are rigged, whether or not it be through message delivery or actual things happening on election day. But, you know, you talk about voter suppression, that type of thing. And so I try and give a lot of examples so the voters kind of better armed to understand what's going on around them in the election process.
So tell me how one goes about it, I guess, because maybe the statute of limitations isn't up and we don't want to go into anything too specifically.
Well, sure.
No,
I'll give you a couple examples. And this is, I'll give you an example of the stuff I did, and then I'll give you an example of how it, something you've actually seen recently. So, for instance, I was managing a campaign once, and we had taken a contribution from a questionable donor, a donor that was going to open up the campaign to some criticism by our opponent. And usually when that happens, campaigns see two solutions. One is give the money back and suffer the consequences, and the other is keep the money and suffer the consequences. But there's always a third way, and the third way is have that questionable donor give a smaller amount that goes unnoticed by the opponent but still gets disclosed in the public disclosure reports, so that when you do get attacked, you can say, well, wait a minute, you took money from the same guy. Why is it okay for you to take the money and it's not okay for me to take the money? So what you're doing is you're exposing your opponent, I say exposing loosely, but exposing your opponent as a hypocrite. And you saw something like this, kind of like this, happen in the presidential Democratic primary when Senator Clinton attacked Senator Obama for taking money from the slumlord Rezco. And then a day later, a photo was released of Senator Clinton and President Clinton smiling next to Mr. Rezco. And so what it does is it derails the attack, it nullifies the attack at best, and at worst, it makes the attacker look like a hypocrite.
And so what are other instances, other methods that you'd use or that one would use, I guess? Can you do this on a national level, or when you rig, to use your terminology, in election, can you only do this on a local or a state level?
Well, I mean, depending on how brazen you are, you can probably do it at any level of an election. Some of this is just about how campaigns are waged, and I use the word wage because, you know, a lot of people in this business think of it as warfare and they wage campaigns against the voter. And the idea is to use to rig elections, and I say rig elections because you're using emotion as leverage to get voters to do what you want, and sometimes get them to do what's not in their self-interest. And so, you know, I give a lot of examples like the two that I just gave of kind of using the system, but then there are other ways of persuading voters to sometimes vote against their self-interest. And that can be rhetoric. And, for instance, you saw it, John McCain was a victim of it, dirty tricks, in 2000 and 2008 in South Carolina. You saw President Clinton take quite a bit of heat for trying to do some of, those types of dirty tricks in the South Carolina primary. So, I can give you some very concrete examples. With the McCain one, it was basically accusing him in 2000 of having an illegitimate biracial child, but when the fact of the matter was, it was his adopted daughter. The President Clinton example has to do with when he said, compared Senator Obama to Jesse Jackson and Jesse Jackson's success in the 84 and 88 South Carolina caucuses. And, you know, that was designed to make Senator Obama, the black candidate. And more than that, it was also designed to remind Jewish voters in New York, which was at that point the next election, of Reverend Jackson's remarks about Hymietown. So these are all things that are designed to trigger emotions in voters, particularly in this case white voters, along lines of, in terms of bigotry. So these are just a couple of examples.
And right now, folks, I'm talking to Alan Raymond. He's the author of How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. But there is a difference between campaigning that is based on rhetoric and actually doing something physically, like trying to shut down the communication system of the other campaign. I mean, you know, we can talk about this sort of lack of ethics and the sort of dirtiness and nastiness of trying to smear John McCain, I guess, with the notion that he had an illegitimate child. But nobody's going to go to prison for that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you saw some flyers that were distributed in South Carolina linking Governor Romney and his Mormon faith to polygamy. You see attacks all the time where people don't obey the law. They don't use, you know, the proper disclosure. And so, you know, look, there is already in New Hampshire this cycle a new investigation involving push polls in New Hampshire. And the state attorney general is looking into this thing that goes back to November of last year in the Republican primary. So, you know, this stuff is going on all the time. And, you know, at the time you may not realize it for what it is, but it, you know, it can step over or cross the bright line of the law.
There was a guy, I guess it was in 2004 or maybe it was 2003. He was a Republican operative, I think out of Detroit, who had said that their strategy was basically to suppress the black vote. Let's talk a little bit about voter suppression. What are some of the means? And would you agree that generally voter suppression is, when we're talking about taking out specific swaths of people, it generally is waged more by Republicans because, to a certain extent, that type of overt suppression, we're not talking rhetorically here, or putting up John McCain as a candidate, I guess. But in terms of, like, actually trying to disenfranchise people from voting, generally that falls around racial or demographic, I guess, groups, because you can easily find demographic groups that would be more apt to vote for Democrats. So what types of voter suppression do we see?
Well, I think, I can only speak from my experience working in the Republican Party. I never worked in the Democratic Party. But, for instance, there's something, a phenomenon called vote caging. And the idea is, you know, you have a right on election day to challenge somebody's credentials to vote. And but to do that, you need to have a reason, and you also need to, you know, have a list. I mean, you literally need to have a list of people who you're going to challenge. And so vote caging was a method that's been used, and, you know, when I first went to the Republican National Committee's Campaign Management College back in 1992, I remember someone lecturing on this. And what it's designed to do is, by using a first-class letter, you target a specific geopolitical region, and it tends to be, you know, lower-income areas. That could certainly be white or black or whatever race, but it can break down on racial lines. And the idea is, by targeting a certain demographic that tends to be migratory, tends to, you know, rent, not live in the same place, not re-register to vote, with the idea that you're going to develop this list and be able to challenge certain voters, meaning you send them the letter, it's a first-class letter. If they're not at that address, the letter comes back. Bingo, you've got a new name to put on your list. And now, so, yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think your assumption is correct.
Now there was this came up, I think, in the hearings regarding the firing of the U.S. attorneys. You're telling me that you went to a training camp for Republican operatives back in the early 90s. Is it possible that people like Monica Goodling and these other U.S. attorneys, who are all basically Republican operatives, weren't aware of this concept of caging?
Well, I can't speak to that. I don't know. I've never asked them. But, I mean, I think caging is a fairly well-known tactic. So, I don't know. But, look, I mean, it's if you work in any type of politics, Democratic or Republican, there's just certain things that you're aware of that that happen, and that's one of them.
So we're talking to Alan Raymond. He's written the book, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. So tell me something. When you did this, you obviously knew it was wrong. Why did you do it?
Well,
know it was wrong?
Well, I'll address that. I mean, politics is not necessarily about morality. Maybe it should be. But, guys like me get hired to win, not to keep the campaign on a moral footing. We certainly look for the moral high ground because that helps. But it was an unusual request. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, given who was making the request, which was a former colleague of mine who was an agent for the Republican National Committee, who made the request on whether or not I could do the work, I took it very seriously. Having worked at the RNC myself, I knew the process of, how these programs get developed. And but it was unusual, and I did take the step to talk to an attorney. The response that I got was that while he didn't recommend it, he didn't see it as being illegal. Now, the mistake I made is I didn't get it in writing, so I always get it in writing. But it was unusual, and unusual enough that I did consult an attorney. But my training told me that you don't step over the bright line of the law, but sometimes you look to go right up to the edge.
All right, we got about 30 seconds here left, but let me ask you this. I mean, was it ideology that was making it possible for you to take that that step or to go right up against the edge, or was it simply, could you be hired by the Democrats to do the same thing?
Well, I mean, I worked in the Republican side of the aisle, but for me it was competitiveness. I mean, it's there is a sentiment of win at all costs out there, and I think that the system's fine. The framers put together a very good system, but there are, and I put myself in this category when I worked in politics, there are a few bad actors out there. And, there's always going to be someone up to no good.
I'm just going to shoot this out there, Alan. Know anything about fixing ballot boxes at all?
Yeah, it's nothing I ever did, but it does raise the issue of electronic voting, voting machines. And the one thing I'll say about that is whatever the reason, whether it's hacking or just deploying a new technology too quickly and too broadly, it raises suspicion, and suspicion is enough.
All right, Alan Raymond, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We got to take a break. It's 48 after the hour. Sam Cedar in for the great Mike Malloy. We'll be right back. We'll take some calls.
Creed written into the founding documents that declare the destiny of the nation. Yes, we can.
We're back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. 53 past the hour. The number is 800-989-1480. A couple of folks have asked me about Mitt Romney on the Sammy Cam. Charlie Nine says, has W. Mitt Romney thrown in the towel for 2008 and his hat for 2012? Well, he's only got $250 million left, folks. And, when you start getting down around I know personally, when I start getting down around the $250 million level, I start to ease off my spending a little bit. I don't know how much he blew through on this campaign. Like 20, 30, 40 million, $50 million? Who knows? But AZBB4 says, since Mitt said that his kids were serving the country, the five brothers were serving the country because they were going around in the Mittmobile in Iowa trying to save the country by getting his dad elected. Now that his dad has dropped out, I can't wait for these guys to sign up. They're right. They should be right out about the at the recruitment center. Let's go to BJ in Talk City, Sacramento, California. Welcome to the program, BJ.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. First, I want to weigh in on the Obama thing, but first I just want to say, man, I've been listening to you for about 2 years. I've been a fan forever. And out of all the talk show hosts and all the people on the progressive side who get on the radio, I just have felt that you were the really had it right. I'm a psychologist, and you always hit back. You had a backbone. You called people on it. And for the longest time, I've been saying that psychologically speaking, you do not get people to change by reinforcing the behavior that you don't want to see. And Republicans and neocons especially are mean and they're bullies. And by kowtowing to them, you just reinforce them doing what they're doing. They have hubris and they just keep a bully up, taking your money on the schoolyard until you walk up to him and hit him in the mouth as hard as you can and let him know that he can't victimize you anymore. Then he'll find another weak target. And Democrats have just been victims for the last 8 years, almost 12 years since they took the Congress, and I've liked the way that you just don't take that stuff. You hit them back every time, and I really appreciate it.
BJ, I appreciate it. I got to say, you're also my favorite caller that I've had in 2 years.
But anyway, what I want to say is that my fear is that, you know, most of voting, like the other guy said, is not about being smart. It's really about emotion. I mean, I think there's a lot of smart people, but people vote on emotion. And my fear is like yours. My fear is a macro fear. It's not just who's going to get elected and what they're going to pass, but I fear for the Supreme Court, civil liberties, the Constitution, and the fact that we are...
Only got 30 seconds, BJ.
But people are so viscerally against Hillary, the Republican. My fear is that that'll overcome any type of fear of racism. And if Hillary is our nominee, that it's going to actually coalesce the Republicans to come out, I think, more than they would be to vote against Barack Obama because he was African American.
Well, BJ, we'll talk about that on the other side. I got to say, I think you're right. I think you're right about that. You're a Hillary supporter, you want to argue the other way, but for me, I support Obama because of electability. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for the great Mike Malloy on Novam Radio. 800-989-1480 is the number. 800-989-1480. Streaming live at NovaM.com. The Sammy Cam is in effect at SamCedarShow.com. You can watch myself and a silent Lauren in New York City in all our glory. Coming up later in this hour, we're going to be talking to Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine. He's going to give us an update on the U.S. torture policy. Apparently now we're admitting we torture. And Michael Mukasey is saying, well, it may be illegal in the future, but I don't want to talk about it. That's basically all we hear from Mukasey, is basically double talk. Nice to see that he takes his position as the chief law enforcement officer of the United States seriously. Meanwhile, you remember all those neocons and those conservative idiots saying, I don't care how the rest of the world thinks about America. We're number one. Well, apparently, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is finding that it's a bit of a problem that the rest of the world sees us as an out-of-control, dangerous, imperialist power, sees us as a rogue nation, essentially. I don't know if any of you remember that we were attacked by some terrorists who were camping out in Afghanistan. And George Bush sent our military there and our Air Force just basically level the place and then diverted about $700 million in the fall of 2002 to ramp up for his Iraq endeavor. Outsourced the job of getting Osama bin Laden at Tora Bora to a bunch of drug lords and warlords. And apparently the Taliban have reamassed after the blessing George Bush gave for Musharraf's deal with the Taliban in western Pakistan last year. I guess a year and a half ago now. Apparently Taliban's back. Mayor of Kabul is just the mayor of Kabul. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said Friday that many Europeans are confused about NATO's security mission in Afghanistan. And that they do not support the alliance effort because they oppose the American-led invasion of Iraq. See, they're confused, ladies and gentlemen. They don't quite get it. And Mr. Gates is so concerned. He says, I worry that for many Europeans, the missions in Iraq and Afghanistan are confused. You see how this is the problem of the Europeans? You see how they don't understand that just because we're waging two wars simultaneously, theoretically, one's an occupation, and one we're basically asking the NATO to pick up the slack because our military is broken. They're confused. They don't understand that somehow that... I don't even know what they're confused about here, according to Robert Gates. I think that they combine the two. Now, of course, we never hear George Bush conflate what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. We never hear them conflate the two so that we don't realize that we're spending $12 billion a month in Iraq and chump change in Afghanistan. That can't possibly be why the Europeans are so confused. Many of them, I think, Gates isn't quite sure about this, have a problem with our involvement in Iraq and project that to Afghanistan and do not understand the very different, for them, the very different kind of threat. In other words, Gates is like, well, it works so well in this country to terrify our populace about the implications of Iraq. What I'm suggesting, Gates is saying, or I guess what I'm saying is that Gates is suggesting that the European countries need to do a little bit more about terrifying their own populace so they can start chipping in Afghanistan. The Times reports, in a public diplomacy strategy somewhat unusual for an American defense secretary, Mr. Gates said he will attempt to speak directly to the people of Europe and not their governments. Quote, in an effort to try and explain why their security is tied to the success in Afghanistan and how success in Afghanistan impacts the future of the alliance. In other words, what he's saying is that, well, look, we know we screwed you folks over by leaving Afghanistan too early. And we dropped the ball. But you're going to pay the price, and I'm going to try and make you understand that you're going to pay the price. This is all fallout, folks, from having I don't even know if you could call it a foreign policy that George Bush has. It's basically just like a bad acid trip that he's imposed on the rest of the country. Let's go to the phones. Charles in Boston, Mass. Listener on the Internet. Welcome to the program, Charles.
Hi, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Pleasure to talk to you. I just wanted to comment on the fact that the it's a bit of a pleasure watching the Republican Party implode, and this is a long time coming. I think that they have ignored the moderates in their ranks, and there actually have been quite a few moderate Republicans, but they've basically been driven out of the party, driven into the ranks of the independents, and quite a few have come over to our side, I think, to become Democrats. It's just amazing to me the hostility that Republicans have for their own, basically. I mean, you listen to Rush Limbaugh. He talks about moderate Republicans as if they have the plague, practically.
Well, I'll tell you, Charles, what's happening here, and this is one of the things which I think is really great about John McCain as their nominee. And now, I, with that said, I do think he's the strongest of their candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, you know, people forget that in 2001, John McCain was ready to jump over to the Democratic Party.
Okay.
But when Jeffords from Vermont beat him to it, he said, screw that, I will now just tack far to the right, go and kiss Jerry Falwell's hand, ring, and attempt to run for president in 8 years, or 4 years, or whatever it was in his mm-hmm. mind. I mean, the guy's ambition is crazy. But what's so great about John McCain is when the Republicans lose, and they will lose with John McCain, I believe that either one of our candidates can beat John McCain. I happen to think that Obama can win by a greater margin, and I happen to think that Obama can help our down tickets more. But I think John McCain's going to lose. And what you're already seeing now is the conservative wing, the base of the Republican Party, who apparently are, who are so marginal that they can't get one of their own elected even nominated in their own party. But they do have the capacity to basically, like a lead weight, sink this party to the bottom of the ocean where they will stay for the next 20 years.
Oh, absolutely.
And when John McCain loses, they're all setting themselves up, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Ann Coulter or Tom DeLay. They're all going to say the reason why he lost is because he wasn't bat crap crazy enough.
But what gets me is that the radical Christian fringe may be very vocal, but they are a minority in this country.
Oh, these people are incredibly marginal. Mm-hmm. But they first of all, you have to remember that they are the definition of the word zealots.
Oh, absolutely.
There were more people who sent emails and calls to support Chris Dodd's filibuster of this FISA bill than sent on immigration, but they're just much louder. And they have control over a large part of the media. So you've got people like Rush and that idiot Sean Hannity espousing this insanity. And they can't even nominate somebody in their own party. But what they do have the capacity to do, they do have the capacity to make sure the Republican Party is a regional party, a very parochial party, one which will never be able to get acceptance with a majority of Americans.
Absolutely. And I think it's a sure thing that the Republicans will lose this election. I mean, here in Boston, there's a conservative named Jay Severin on the radio who was a Mitt Romney worshiper. And now that Mitt is out of the race, he's basically saying he's not going to vote. And anyone who is a true conservative cannot be behind John McCain. So we need to look to 2012. For the election, so
yeah, they're just looking for an excuse at this point, because I got news for you, Mitt Romney mm-hmm. would have lost about five times greater of a deficit than John McCain, and Mike Huckabee, I think he would have taken one state.
I think you're right.
All right, Charles, I appreciate the phone call. We got to take a break. 800-989-1480 is the number. I'll take some more calls when we get back. Cedar in from Malloy. It's 16 after the hour. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. Numbers 800-989-1480. Coming up in the next segment, Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine. Give us an update on U.S. torture policy. Michael Mukasey refusing to answer any questions about anything, essentially. Let's go to Philip in St. Louis, listening on Sirius. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Hi, Sam. I called in to say that I think Hillary Clinton represents conventional wisdom, which basically says that we cannot achieve our ideals. We have to work with what we have, and therefore I support Obama. I think he represents an idealism that has been missing in our debate. And I think if, you know, we may not have what we need to achieve our ideals today, but if we don't start building it, we won't have it tomorrow either.
You know, I mean, that's, I think that's a big part of his appeal, that he's inspirational, and he gives a sense of being forward thinking in some ways. I appreciate the call, Philip. Let's go to Molly, listening on Sirius in Tampa, Florida. Welcome to the program, Molly.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good, I'm good. I love you.
Oh, well, thank you, Molly. That's very kind.
Yes, I just have a quick question for you, your personal opinion. Do you think that the David Schuster comment, actually it's a two-part question, do you think the David Schuster comment, it being pretty similar to that which Don Imus made about the girls' basketball team quite a while ago, do you think that will be as popular a talking point tomorrow and in the subsequent weeks ahead?
Well, they've already suspended him.
Oh, right. I just mean, do you think people are going to be as up in arms about it?
No, I don't think so, because, frankly, I don't think it is really... I wouldn't equate it with what Imus said. I don't think there was any racial overtones to it. And
right,
I think,
exactly. They were both sexist remarks, but only the one with the racial remarks is going to actually get...
Yeah, I think the racial issue is more, and I don't... I'll tell you something. I've heard people use pimp... Not just for women. I mean, you know, I didn't perceive it that way. I thought it was inappropriate because, look, it's her daughter. I mean, if it was her son, I mean, I've said Mitt Romney was out pimping his kids around or whatever. You know, the real question, when you look at John McCain said back, I think in 93, made a joke, Janet Reno and Hillary Clinton had a kid. It was Chelsea Clinton or something to that effect.
Right. I'm just wondering about the equations and what we deem okay and what we don't, especially in this campaign. And I know a lot of people out there are really for Obama. Why, I have no idea. But, I mean, what Michelle Obama said about how if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, she doesn't think she'll vote for her.
No. All right. First of all,
you want to talk divisive.
Wait a second, Molly. All right. I've seen that comment misconstrued, and basically she didn't say that. What she said was she didn't know if she would be out there stumping for her. She said she would support her in terms of voting for her. But what she said was, the specific quote was, I don't know if I would go out there and actively campaign for her.
I wonder if Bill Clinton said that, if it would be the same thing.
Probably not. But he's the former president and arguably the most important official in the Democratic Party.
No, I think what I'm just trying to get is your opinion, and I've got it now, on what we deem as important enough to talk about, and how we criticize people's comments, and with, you know, the level of magnifying glass that we look into people's comments.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I didn't.
Obama and Michelle Obama can say pretty much anything they want, and that's all right.
I think Molly, that certainly Barack Obama has gotten away with rhetoric that I would be less inclined, I would not have supported it if it came from a different person who didn't have other qualities and other values that I see as being, an attribute in terms of what I want to see politically happen.
I agree.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. Anybody else came out and said Social Security's in crisis, I would be hammering them. And I didn't, I brought it up, and I didn't appreciate the comment.
Right.
But I think, you know, what Barack Obama does rhetorically is that he basically speaks a lot of the language of the moderates and the conservatives. You know, to me, it's a crapshoot. I think that there's a very good chance, if I had to say odds on, they're going to be the same president, more or less. But the difference is, and this is the difference in my estimation, is that Obama will have better ability to get more Democrats elected down ticket than Clinton. And that Obama will probably go in with more of a mandate than Clinton. That's basically how I make my determination.
Now, this is a quick question. Has he ever voted on the civil unions with gays being a federal, you know, federally
DOMA?
Accepted? Or,
I don't think that vote ever came up. I don't know if it came up when he was in the Senate, to be honest with
you. Oh, okay, that was my only question. Has he ever spoken on that?
You know, I know that from his perspective, he's come out and he said, I'm for civil unions. I don't think we're ready yet for gay marriage. I think personally he supports it, and I've actually heard him say equate it to, if I was advising Martin Luther King back during the Civil Rights Act, that I would have told him, go for the vote. Go for the Civil Rights Act. Don't focus on miscegenation laws, which basically in some states prevented blacks and whites from marrying. I think he's a very pragmatic politician. Too pragmatic for my taste, but I got two choices. And that's it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Scott Horton, Cedar in from Malloy. We'll be right back.
Our time has come. Our movement is real. And change is coming to America.
We are back. It's 34 past the hour. Sam Cedar in from Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio, streaming live at NovaMRadio.com. Sammy Cam is in effect at SamCedarShow.com. You can see me in all my glory. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I did get a haircut. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome Scott Horton. He's a New York attorney specializing in human rights and international law. He writes the blog No Comment for Harper's Magazine online at harpers.org. Welcome to the program, Scott. Oh, sorry about that. Scott, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
So Michael Mukasey's been up on the Hill of the past couple of days, along with General Hayden. And it seems that we have been torturing.
That's right. It's out there now, fully confessed.
This is a little different. George Bush, didn't he get in front of the country and say, we do not torture?
I was trying to keep count of the number of times. It's certainly more than 300 that he said that. And as I recount it, we go back to early in the spring of 2004, he's aggressive, shouting it as if he's angry that someone would even ask him. And then more recently, he's sort of looking down and not very convincingly saying, we do not torture. Well, of course, the gig is up right now because it's acknowledged that we do torture.
Now what the...
Or we did. We did.
We did torture.
Yes.
Yes, we did torture. Maybe that's what he was saying. When he said, we do not torture, what he was referring to was at that very moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem that there is an attempt to sort of wiggle around the definition of torture here that Mukasey continues to engage in.
That's exactly right. I mean, basically what he's told us is that his Office of Legal Counsel has rendered an opinion that concludes that all the techniques that the administration is using do not constitute torture. But he won't really tell us what that opinion is or how they come to those conclusions or even what techniques specifically have been reviewed. He basically says, trust us.
And do you trust him?
Not at all.
The amazing thing here is, when we are determining whether something is legal or not in this situation, can a unilateral brief by the Department of Justice determine something's legality?
Well, we have something called the Judiciary Act of 1789, one of the earliest statutes, and it says for purposes of legal disputes within the government, within the executive branch, the attorney general has the power to give a legal opinion. And when that legal opinion is given, it's binding on all the agencies of the executive branch. And that's what they're relying on here. They're saying, I've rendered an opinion, that's it, it's binding. And by the way, it doesn't make any difference that the opinion says black is white and up is down. It's an opinion. And based on that note, Attorney General Mukasey is saying, I don't need to look into or launch a criminal investigation into these waterboarding incidents. I mean, waterboarding is clearly accepted around the world as torture, was clearly accepted in the United States as torture. We have an opinion from the Supreme Court of Mississippi from 1926. We have an opinion of the Judge Advocate General from 1902 that says that. Lots and lots of precedent.
We prosecuted Japanese. We prosecuted Japanese soldiers too, didn't we? Back in after World War II.
Not only did we prosecute them, the United States took the position that the appropriate punishment was the death penalty. It was subject to capital punishment. And we executed them. I guess, you know, Mukasey should be sending out letters to all the families of those we executed saying, sorry, on further reflection, it was a complicated decision and we were wrong, a complicated issue and we were wrong.
Now, how can he make this argument? We're talking to Scott Horton. He is a New York attorney specializing in human rights and international law. He writes the blog No Comment for Harper's Magazine online. How can he make the argument that this is solely a legal issue within the context of the administration? Because isn't the statutes that outlaw torture, aren't they legislative? I mean, we have the No Torture Act, I guess, from 96, and we have the Geneva Conventions. And these are all ratified by the Senate. It seems to me that this involves two branches of government.
Well, it involves three, because it also involves the courts. I mean, the courts would make a determination. The courts are not going to be bound by this memorandum that's been issued by the Office of Legal Counsel. In fact, the courts very likely would find that that memorandum is incorrect. And I'll go one step further. I'll say I believe that Attorney General Mukasey and the author of the memorandum, Stephen Bradbury, believe that their memoranda are incorrect legally, and they're issuing them only to shield and protect members of the administration. And, you know, we saw a sign of that just yesterday when Michael Hayden, Director of Central Intelligence, under questioning, says, I always questioned whether or not this was legal. Even he's saying he doesn't believe it's legal. He knows he has an opinion that says it is, but he doesn't believe that opinion is right. Nobody believes that opinion is right.
Now, that's a pretty stunning thing that you're saying there, Scott, because I know that, you know, when we spoke when Mukasey was going through his confirmation hearings, and you were very skeptical and you felt that he should not be confirmed, but you did have a glimmer of hope. But I don't think that even you would have predicted at that time that Mukasey would go out there and forcefully advocate for something that he knew was wrong on a legal basis, simply to give cover for this administration.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, one thing I talked about earlier was that, you know, and we revealed, and we've gotten some information, more detail about, is that while his nomination was going through the review process, the White House asked him to meet with a group of neocon lawyers, movement conservative lawyers, they're called, a group of them. And we know that those lawyers in meeting with him were pushing two things. One was, we want your absolute assurance that you're not going to authorize any independent investigations into the White House. And the other is, you know, you're going to back up the torture program. Now, I'd say based on what he's done, it's pretty clear that he gave those assurances. And it's also clear that this was a quid pro quo for his nomination to be Attorney General. It was essentially a litmus test. Just as in the past, we know the administration used the abortion issue, used same-sex marriage, flag burning, a series of other things as litmus tests. Those things are all out the window. They really don't matter. Now the litmus test is torture. That's it.
You know, this is really stunning stuff. I mean, I got to say, maybe I find it just so shocking. I was raised by a family of lawyers, and the notion that this guy was a judge, a sitting judge, he hasn't been a political operative per se, and that he would just go in and basically throw away his entire career. He obviously had some measure of respect from people. Chuck Schumer basically blessed and suggested his nomination. It's pretty stunning that he would throw all that away to basically protect lawbreakers.
Well, in fact, you know, Chuck Schumer at the end of the last hearing said, I'm not surprised at what you're saying, but I'm very disappointed. And I think that, you know, that summarizes the reaction of a lot of people who were Michael Mukasey's friends and spoke for him in the process. I think they expected that he was going to be someone who would exercise independent judgment and would do the right thing and wouldn't be guided completely by politics. But, you know, he's turned out to be very broadly guided by politics. And one of the real giveaways is that, you know, after his testimony in the Senate Judiciary Committee, One of the senior staffers for Vice President Cheney went rushing over to the National Review blog and wrote an entry saying, "I was mistaken about Mukasey. I had my reservations about him, and now I'm delighted. He's our man." Well, that sort of sums it up. Yes, he is their man.
It really is just it really is just stunning. I don't know why it wasn't. You know, of course, Alberto Gonzalez was no better, maybe worse, but at least he had that stink of being a political operative, and had been, you know, had this relationship with Bush. In some ways, it wasn't quite as shocking to see someone sell their entire integrity down the river to protect people in this situation. But let's turn for a moment to Bradbury. Who is Stephen Bradbury, and why is his he has been the acting, I guess, assistant attorney general of the Office of Legal Counsel. He has been the acting, holding this position on an acting level. Why is the Senate refusing to, or hopefully refusing, to confirm him?
Well, he's referred to among lawyers these days as U2. That's Y-O-O. And then the number two, because he has basically picked up where John Yoo left off in that office. And I'd say the focus on him has to do with the torture issue. Now, if we go all the way back to the months immediately after 9/11, we know that John Yoo and Jay Bybee wrote a memorandum basically saying, if the president authorizes it, it's not torture. So that means waterboarding and whatever else you want to do, long-time standing, hypothermia, psychotropic drugs, sleep deprivation beyond 2 days, all that's perfectly okay if the president wants to do it.
Let me just clarify here. Now, we heard Nixon say if the president does it, it's not illegal. When this guy writes the memo, is he saying that if the president authorizes it, it's not torture, or he's saying that if it's torture, it's legal in this instance?
He's saying that it does not constitute torture because we have to read in an exception for the president exercising his commander-in-chief authority. And that's a view, by the way, that is rejected by 99.9% of the legal community. I mean, you know, I've asked, NPR called me one evening and said, who can we find who will defend this position? And I said, John Yoo. And they said, but anyone else? And I said, probably not in public. There really aren't other people. Now, the other private people who hold that view, I mean, Stephen Bradbury seems to be one. And after John Yoo left, we had a new man running this office called Dan Levin, and he repudiated the Yoo memorandum.
He's the one who actually had himself waterboarded and determined it was torture.
Exactly right. And when he did that and started to write a new memorandum clarifying that, you know, most usages of waterboarding would not be permitted, he was immediately fired. We know that it just raised immediate alarm inside of the White House, the Vice President's office, and Alberto Gonzalez. He was removed from this position immediately, and they selected Stephen Bradbury to come in. And Stephen Bradbury is a founding member of the Federalist Society, was a clerk for Clarence Thomas, and basically is viewed as someone who is politics, partisan politics, a first, second, and last. That's it. So he writes opinions that reflect whatever the person who commissions them want them to say. I think that's pretty clear. And, you know, with respect to these memos, we have the view of James Comey, who was the deputy attorney general, the number two under Gonzalez, who looked at some of Bradbury's memos and said, when these things become public, it is going to shame the Justice Department.
Well, I frankly haven't seen enough of the shame. One of the interesting things I caught with Mukasey on the Hill was he seems to be arguing that torture is not defined by the act, but by the circumstances under which it's performed. In other words, you can have so-called mitigating circumstances, which changes the definition of an act from torture to just one of the things you got to do.
Well, I think I believe that's right, but he hasn't been clear about it in any of his testimony, and he hasn't allowed us to look at these memoranda. But, you know, there's some giveaways. I think he also seems to be implying that it depends on who the person is. That is, if you do something to me, Michael Mukasey, yes, it's torture. Or if you do it to Mike McConnell, it's torture. But if you do it to, Abu Zubaydah, it's not torture because he's someone that you can freely torture. It's a little circular.
Wow. Just unbelievable. And apparently he's not going to go after whether or not he's not going to look into the wireless wiretapping. He's not going to uphold any of the subpoenas. Mukasey is basically just, it's a bag job.
I think he's going to block any attempt to look into the White House. But I think we've got something significant coming up here because there is an internal Department of Justice investigation looking into the Gonzales Eight, the eight U.S. attorneys who were fired. And, you know, my sources are telling me that this investigation is close to being concluded, and it is finding very serious wrongdoing involving Alberto Gonzales. That it's come to a real focus on what went on in New Mexico.
All right. Well, Scott, we'll check in with you as that story breaks. Maybe they're throwing Gonzales under the bus.
I think that's likely.
Wow. No honor amongst thieves. Scott Horton, New York attorney, he writes the blog No Comment for Harper's Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We got to take a break, folks. It's Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy on NOVAM Radio, 800-989-1480. We'll be right back after this.
What you want in the papers you run, we'll never force a confession after we torture our prisoners. The oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free after we torture our prisoners.
Back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy on NOVAM Radio, streaming live at NOVAM.com. Numbers 800-989-1480. The Sammy Cam is in effect, ladies and gentlemen. And I am almost shaven. Almost shaven, not quite. Let's go to the phones. Todd, calling from Coconut Grove, Florida, listening on Winds. Welcome to the program, Todd.
Thank you, Sam. First time I've had the pleasure to speak with you, and I just wanted to say that you can count me as one of those who thinks you're a nice guy and highly intelligent and talented.
Oh, well, thank you, Todd.
You're welcome. I listen to Mike religiously, with the exception of 9 to 10 on Friday evenings, because I watch Bill Moyers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've heard this or not, but tonight he had an expose which included a movie that has the word taxi in it.
Taxi to the Dark Side.
Oh, okay, that's it, yeah. And it was a frightening thing to watch. And
the movie is getting limited release around the country right now, and apparently it was supposed to be on, now I may be wrong about which channel it was. I think it was the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, I don't have cable, so I...
And they basically pulled it off.
I wouldn't doubt that.
They bumped it because it was too
political,
it was too controversial, even though it's simply documented fact.
Yeah,
nobody's refuting whether or not it's true.
Right.
It's just that it might be a little bit too difficult for the American public to realize that they are a regime that tortures.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to report that, but I had two other quick statements, and then I'll just listen. I'm one of those. I don't think we're going to get these two SOBs while they're in office, but I'm praying that the world court gets them. That's what I'm hoping, for the sake of this country and our reputation. And also, another thing you touched on tonight, Social Security, there's one thing that's been bothering me, because I have always said, or asked, why, rhetorically, I guess, why there's a cap on Social Security. But when that subject came up during a debate, I don't know if you noticed it or not, it was asked to Hillary, and she totally ignored the question.
Yeah, so, well, Obama came out and said that we should raise the cap on Social Security. Hillary's position in that debate was, I'm not going to start negotiating with myself. Now, I didn't quite fully get that. I think that may be a legitimate answer, but I'm not sure.
What does that mean, Sam? What does that mean?
That she's not going to negotiate with herself? Well, she's basically saying that we're X months out, from anybody becoming president, and you don't want to tip your hand as to what the deal is. Now, of course,
I see.
Now, of course, with that said, now I got to let you go, Ty. We're up against the break.
Yeah, right.
Appreciate the call. Now, with that said, however, she's doing it with health care. There is some argument that if you open the door to saying that Social Security needs to be fixed, that Bush will come in and the Republicans will try and trash Social Security. But frankly, there is a very easy fix. It's not even really broken. No, it's basically like saying my car is broken because I only have half a tank of gas. No, the car is not broken. Eventually, you're going to have to stop and get a little more gas. Maybe that means lifting the cap. Maybe that means a donut hole. All right, well, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. 800-989-1480. Cedar in from Malloy. We are back. Sam Cedar in for the great Mike Malloy. That's right, Truth Seekers. Coming up in our next segment, we're going to be talking to Leonard Pierce, a mole in the bowels, and I do mean bowels, of the Conservative Political Action Committee, or CPAC, conference. Actually, I don't know. This raises an interesting question. If the entire conference is really just one large bowel, can it have bowels within bowels? In some respects, it's the bowels of the country, the CPAC conference. You got Dick Cheney showed up there, and they cheered this man. These people are psychopaths. I started off with the program with this, but this still just shocks the conscience. And maybe I shouldn't put it up there with that Taxi to the Dark Side. That movie is, I think, very disturbing. But this is also disturbing. George Bush in speaking to the Conservative Political Action Conference. And God, I hope he gets out there and campaigns like the Dickens for John McCain. I hope he's sitting there going, historians are going to look back at me and see like George Washington. They're going to look at me at George Washington. You say he was just like George Washington, they're going to say. And that's why John McCain, I better campaign with him. He could be my standard bearer. He said today, my energy is up, my spirit is high. I will finish strong. I don't even know what that means. Sounds like somebody's there really like, you know, it's like the guy with the major drinking problem. You know, everybody know that one heroin addict in the office who at the beginning of the week makes sure he gets the haircut, shaven, you know, he's trying to look like, he's not falling apart. George Bush sounds like he is on the verge of a nervous breakdown and he is genuinely afraid he's just not going to make it. I mean, what does this mean? My energy is up, my spirit is high, and I will finish strong. Why don't you just go, ladies and gentlemen, me doth protest too much. I'm not going to tell you what I'm protesting too much about. In the meantime, we will elect a new president. We've had good debates, and soon we'll have a nominee who will carry a conservative banner into this election and beyond. See, this is they're like warriors. Except for their chicken hawks. They're like warriors, except they wage that war sitting on their arses. Listen, the stakes in November are high. This is an important election. Prosperity and peace are in the balance. I almost couldn't deliver that last line that he delivered, because it is so incredibly, it's such an insane thing to say. Even with his own logic, he just may not realize where he is, or what day it is, or what year it is. And Dick Cheney, got a standing ovation saying President Bush has made the right decisions for the right reasons. He declared, "Would I support those same decisions today? You're damn right I would. And I'd shoot that guy in the face all over again." And they just erupt in a sea of insanity. Let's go to the phones. Gregory in Northern Kentucky. Sirius. Welcome to the program. Gregory, you there?
Yeah.
What's happening, man?
Can you... nothing much. How are you?
I'm great.
I'm a little nervous here.
You're making me nervous, buddy.
Don't be.
No, I'm joking. You know, you're doing great.
Well, you got mighty big shoes to fill in there, you know. Well,
you don't have to fill my shoes. You're doing great.
I'm talking about you and Mike, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, yeah, that's absolutely right.
That's why I'm nervous. I'm afraid he'll just tell me, hey, you know, and he sent me on my way, right? But I want to...
We're getting there.
...say a statement, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Okay.
McCain is Bush's bitch.
Well, you know, it would sort of depend on how you define that. I mean, he's shown that his ambition, he's willing...
Okay, the war will continue if McCain is elected president.
Oh, see, all right, then Gregory, I'm going to have to say, I'm sorry. In terms of the way you're defining a bitch in that regard, you're wrong.
Well, why? Why?
I'll
tell
you
why.
Because... it's not John McCain extending George Bush's war. John McCain was the choice of every neoconservative thinker and pundit and official in that 2000 race. And do you know why? Because
no.
John McCain has been talking about invading Iraq for years.
Well,
Four years.
Okay, well, answer me this.
He'll take us to Iran.
Can I? I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, go ahead.
Who do the Bush people want to win the Republican nomination?
Well, you know,
because they're all very, very much distancing themselves from W there, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess McCain probably is the guy that they would want out of this crew, maybe Mitt Romney.
Corporations, man.
Yeah, I hear you, Gregory. I mean, to a certain extent, I've been saying from the very beginning that it seemed to me the Republican establishment was just basically saying, you know, there's a real crap storm on the horizon. Maybe it's time to sit this one out and scream about how bad things are and try and blame the Democrats. I don't know. But I guess at the end, I guess they wanted McCain. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Leonard Pierce, a mole who's been hiding out. It's CPAC. We'll be right back. Cedar in for Malloy. I just want to sink to the bottom with you. I just want to.
I wanna be a Republican. I'm tired of doing what I should. Wanna do what I can. Grab as much as I can. Keep it all for me. Cause life is a party, and the grand old party is a party where I wanna be.
Lower taxes are God's plan.
We are back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. 18 after the hour. Numbers 800-989-14. We'll get to calls in the next segment. On the phone, Leonard Pierce. He's a freelance writer, and he blogs for SadlyNo.com, a very funny blog, actually, and is giving, I don't know if it's satire or if it's just you're witnessing something so insane, Leonard. You're deep in the bowels of the bowels. You're in the Conservative Political Action Conference. Is that right?
I like to think of it as the pit. Yeah, that's where I am right now.
Now you've been there for 2 days. Are you slowly going insane? I mean, does the sun shine where you are now? What happens?
I'm exhausted. I've actually been here since Wednesday night because they had a banquet for the early, you know, the diamond exhibitors, as they call them, the big shots who paid the big money, and so I've eaten a lot of mashed potatoes and. I've heard Ronald Reagan's name so many times it's begun to lose all meaning. You can only hear Ronald Reagan in Tax Cuts so many times before you just want to start crying.
You know, the whole Reagan worship from there is fascinating because I don't remember it being this strong ever. I think it's sort of because they do not have a candidate to rally around. They're sort of worshiping this. I mean, they've always done this. They've always tried to mythologize this guy, but it seems like even more extreme this year. And of course, they have to rewrite history and not tell everybody that he raised taxes. And they have to rewrite history and not tell everybody that he invented amnesty, or people would start to, I guess, have breakdowns or something.
Exactly. They're completely whitewashing the real Reagan, but, When Romney dropped out of the race, you know, you could just hear people crying from one end of the building to the other because they had designated him the new Reagan, and that just shows how desperate they are to find a new Reagan, that they're willing to settle for a non-entity like Romney and dub him the new Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy who basically said, 10 years ago, I am not looking to extend Reagan-Bush.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well...
Yeah,
so- tell me a little bit of what you've seen. Tell me a little bit about the hatred for John McCain, because on the TV, it sounded like there were some people actually cheering for him.
There were a few people, and he's got his backers. You know, it was kind of funny, right before Romney made his big announcement, I had gotten tipped off ahead of time that he was going to do it, so I headed over to his speech to hear him make the big confession, and you could see all these Young Americans for Freedom kids, you know, in the hallways tearing off their Romney buttons and replacing them with McCain buttons. But he got a lot of boos, and it's because, you know, he's not rabidly conservative enough for this crowd. You know, you have to remember this is not the typical Republican crowd here. This is the real right-wing conservative crowd. So for them, you know, anybody to the left of Father Coughlin is just unacceptable. And, so McCain, you know, was just, when Ann Coulter gave her speech today, you know, she was pretty much straight up comparing John McCain to Stalin, you know, saying that he was, you know, we might as well vote for Hillary. That's her big shtick right now, is that we might as well vote for Hillary rather than McCain. And the biggest cheers that McCain got was when he dissed Barack Obama and when he mentioned Mitt Romney. Every other thing that he said was just a very lukewarm reception. And it was sad to see the guy, if you have any respect for him at all, how much he was abasing himself to the right-wingers. He just kept saying, oh, I know I've made mistakes. I know I haven't always done the right thing. And I'm counting on you people to show me what to do. And, you know, he might as well just have dropped down on his hands and knees and turned around and asked them to kick him in the butt.
Or other things. I mean, that's why we call him the pander bear around here. You know, it seems to me it's not so much that he isn't conservative, but that he hasn't been, you know, that modern conservatism has less to do with a certain ideology and more of just this sort of like quasi-political correctness where you have to just simply take some knee-jerk positions that aren't necessarily conservative per se, but they just, you have to you have to show that you're willing to be a team member. I mean, you know, Mitt Romney, case in point, rather. Here was a guy who was not really conservative, but he was willing to essentially lie so prone to these people and throw everything down the sell everything down the river that they said, okay, you're one of us, more because you're willing to allow yourself to be part of the Borg.
Well, you know, I think that's the same thing with Reagan. You know, that's why they idolized Reagan, and that's what they saw in Romney. I mean, I didn't even think Reagan was that big of a, you know, ultra-conservative by today's standards. He was just sort of a blank, friendly face that didn't like to argue, you know. When people told him, well, get out there and say this and take this position and take that position, he didn't moan about it. You know, he just went out there and did it. And I think that's what they're looking for, is just some cipher who will go out and tell him whatever, you know, just go out and say whatever they tell him to say. And I think that's what they saw in Romney. I mean, Romney's a constant flip-flopper. His positions have changed on everything. He's never really had a consistent ideology. But when his name started getting bandied around for the nomination this year, you know, he was able to change his opinions to suit whatever they wanted him to say, and that's why they loved him so much. I don't really think the guy is some kind of huge right-wing ideologue at all.
Yeah, and to be fair to Reagan, there's a good chance that for like the last 3 or 4 years of his presidency, he really wasn't in any shape to argue with anybody. I mean, you know, the guy was lucky if he could drool at that point. But that aside, tell me about the chance of four more years. That's right up there with George Bush saying that peace and prosperity hang in the balance in this election.
Yeah, the four more years chant I first heard when I went to see Dick Cheney speak, which was pretty fun, you know. They have his picture up on the giant screen so people in the back of the room can see him, and it gives you that really creepy Big Brother vibe because he's definitely got that authoritarian mane to him. But, you know, when he first came on, you know, he got a standing ovation, and when he finished his speech, a bunch of the young Republicans, which that's who I was sitting with at the time, especially started chanting four more years, which kind of cracked me up, you know, being unconstitutional and all that. But when they continued the chant for Bush the next day, he gave a speech very early in the morning, and they chanted four more years before and after his speech. And I got to thinking, not only are they cheering for something that's unconstitutional, but something they shouldn't want at all. Because I would love it if Bush was able to run for a third term, because he'd get crushed. You know, he's so unpopular right now. I would be thrilled if he was able to run for a third term. If he was the Republican Party candidate, I'd be giddy. You know, so I don't know why that's something they would want, considering how low his poll numbers are right now.
Well, it really is. I mean, almost the definition of the word at this point, to be conservative, necessitates, by definition, a huge dose of delusion.
Now, that is on display everywhere you look at this conference, I'll tell you that much.
Now,
everywhere you go, a nonstop parade of delusion.
Now, I assume a lot of these guys probably were there in military gear heading off back to Iraq. They just came back from the conference, you know, a lot of these young people you're talking about, right?
Strangely enough, that is not the case. You know, one thing that a lot of my friends have been asking me is, you see a lot of military recruiters there because, you know, a lot of the people attending are young men of military age, you know, guys in high school. You have all the young conservative clubs from college campuses are here. I have not seen one military recruiter the whole time I'm here. There really hasn't even been that much talk about the war. In fact, the first conference the first panel that I went to was about whether or not St. Reagan would have gone to Iraq. And the consensus of the people on the panel was that he wouldn't. And then Dick Cheney came by and, you know, everybody talked about the war for about 5 minutes. And then they got back to sort of pretending it wasn't really happening. And, you don't see people in uniform there. You don't see any military recruiters there. There's just a really big avoidance of talking about what's happening on the ground in Iraq. But they sure are eager to talk about going to Iran. You know, they're already moving on to the next war. So.
All right. Well, Leonard Pierce, the work you're doing on Sadly No there is great stuff, folks. Go over and check this out. It's sadlyno.com. Leonard has literally been swimming in the bowels of the country. And the stuff is hilarious, but smelly. Leonard, thanks for joining us. We got to take a break. Sam Cedar in for the great Mike Malloy. Number is 800-989-1480. We'll be right back after this.
Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan. I work for Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan.
A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Set your mouth and open up your heart. And baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
Right, exactly, Charlie.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
We are back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. 34 past the hour. Number's 800-989-1480. We're streaming live at NovaM.com. NovaMRadio.com. Excuse me. And, of course, the Sammy Cam is in full effect at SamCedarShow.com. Let's go to the phones. People have been waiting patiently. Lacey, calling from Burlington, Washington, 1090 AM. Welcome to the program, Lacey.
Hi, Sam.
How are you?
I'm good. I have to tell you, though, four more years chant made me a little dizzy. I had to sit down.
I can imagine. What overcame you? The idea that these people are so deluded, or just the concept?
I think it would have to be both. A little bit of both. I can't imagine anyone actually saying that seriously. But you know, I guess there are some.
It continues to shock me to this day. But
yeah.
I mean, the polls say that they're out there. I have not met them.
I am glad I have not either. So that's good. But I called today because I was at the Obama rally in Seattle this morning.
This is at the Key Arena.
It was at the Key Arena, yeah.
Wow.
And they actually let about 18,000 people in when capacity was 13,000.
Wow.
And they said there were 3,000 outside that couldn't get in. And they actually started late because Obama went outside and greeted and talked to everybody outside who couldn't get in.
That's amazing. Well,
yeah.
He's expected to win the caucus there tomorrow.
He is. I will be there. I will be caucusing, and I'm excited. I will be at a smaller precinct, but I'm hoping that the turnout is going to be as big as it has been over the rest of the country. So,
now, Lacey, why do you support Barack Obama?
You know, initially, I was someone who would have supported Kucinich, because I guess I'm that liberal. I don't know. I don't know how else to say it. But
well,
Obama,
I mean, frankly, I think I think there's a lot of people who, I mean, I would prefer. There. Let me put it this way: 90, and I can't even come up with what the 10% is, but 90% of what Kucinich plans were, I supported.
Yeah, yeah, I was the same way. And you know, as time went on, it became apparent that, you know, he wouldn't go all the way, and I started looking
right.
at other candidates, and I did a lot of research on Obama's website and just started learning about him, and I started watching some of his speeches, and he is just really incredible and inspiring, and the way that he talks is, it's positive and it's uplifting, and he talks about being a community, and it just feels about time that there's a politician who speaks that way instead of, oh my gosh, everyone in the world wants to kill us, so let's start a war. And it feels nice. So I was determined to see him in person, and I did, and it was great. I got right behind the stage. I've been watching myself on YouTube all night, popping in and out from behind him, and I was that close, and it was really just absolutely incredible. And the whole feeling in the Key Arena was amazing. Everybody was just hyped and excited, and he was great.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call, Lacey. There you have it, folks. 23,000 people showing up at the Key Arena in Seattle. I mean, here's the thing. Have you ever heard anybody refer to a politician in this way? I mean, did anybody ever go to a John Kerry event, see a John Kerry speech, and have that reaction? And we hear this over and over again. Now, you can say whatever. Maybe some people don't feel it's worthwhile, whatever it is. But, I mean, did you ever hear anybody talk about any politician that way? There has to be value in that. There has to be value in that. Tom in San Diego, California, listening on Sirius. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Yeah. Are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, what I'm calling about is you said you want to talk about raising the cap on Social Security.
Right.
Well, what about the $2 trillion that's already owed Social Security by the federal government?
Well, look, as far as I'm concerned, that money is there. You have Treasury bonds in there, and that money is in the trust fund. Right now, assuming all that money is in the trust fund, the trust fund is completely solvent until 2041, 2042. Now, remember, these statistics also come from the appointees of the Bush administration. So, you know, but let's say we just believe that. In 2042, the trust fund runs out, and then you will be paid out 80% of your benefits as promised today. If we do nothing whatsoever. So if you raise the cap to 110, 120, the first 120,000, or if you do not hold it, after the first 100,000, you get a break for the next 50,000, and then it kicks back in at 151,000. If you do these minor adjustments, you will take Social Security off the table forever.
What? my understanding has always been that they always owed the money to that the federal government's always owed the money to the Social Security.
Well, I mean, they have treasury bills in there, basically, and you could say yes, technically those are IOUs, but the U.S. government has never defaulted on those ever.
Oh, really?
They're practically currency, and you know this is what now. There's going to have to be, out of the general fund, we're going to have to find some money. But basically, George Bush raided the Social Security Trust Fund.
This was Ronald Reagan.
Oh, well, yes. Well, George, I don't know if Reagan did that, but I do know that they raised payroll taxes to weather this upcoming sort of demographic shift. But if you remember, Al Gore kept saying, lockbox, lockbox, lockbox. And what
right.
he was saying was, look, we should make it an accounting principle that you can, the general fund cannot borrow money, or that the Social Security fund, rather, is separate from the general fund. So monies collected specifically for Social Security cannot go into the general fund to make up for, let's say, George Bush's tax cuts on the rich, which is exactly what George Bush did. I appreciate the call, Tom. Let's go to... Robert in Dallas, Texas, 1360. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Hey, Sam. I'm wondering, why are we spending so much time on the Republicans? We all know they suck. The real problem right now for the progressive movement is the Democrats. It seems like they are just, they used us to get into power, and now they're throwing us away. I mean, where are all the hearings, the impeachment hearings? Where is the talk on the investigation on 9/11? I mean, why have the Democrats abandoned gay rights? Where's all that? I mean, why have they just abandoned us?
All right. Well, I will say this, Robert. You know, I think from a legislative perspective, I never had any expectations that they'd be able to do anything legislatively because they simply don't have the majorities. I have been incredibly disappointed in the lack of hearings, the lack of intensity of hearings. Yeah, that's a problem. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, my perspective on it, and I do talk about it a lot, I mean, I would like to see them be more aggressive. But at this point, the next best thing to do is attempt to elect more and better Democrats. I mean, look, you know, the Democratic Party is just a vessel, and it's the best chance that we have to influence these things. I agree with you. I am extremely disappointed, and I was saying earlier, we should be impeaching these people. I was sat on a panel in New York City in the summer of 2006 with Conyers, and he has a book, you know, thicker than my thigh, and I can assure you I have very thick thighs, with what stuff that should come up under a select committee to impeach. Mm-hmm. And these guys were basically spineless about it. I mean, the FISA vote. You know, I don't know why Jay Rockefeller is saying that we need immunity for telecommunications companies. You know, and I'm just basically, you know, all I'm doing, Robert, is I'm trying to figure out the best way to get to a point where they become less and less relevant, these people.
What do you think about the third party, maybe? Maybe the progressive movement ought to get all our resources and push towards that. I mean, maybe with time.
Well, Robert, I could tell you this. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. Now, granted, I did it in New York State, and I knew that it wasn't going to be a question as to whether or not Gore would win, and I vote swap with somebody in Florida. But I'm certainly sympathetic to that notion. But what happened after that? Nader didn't try and build a party. He didn't try and do anything. You know, I think if you're really interested in a third party, the way to do it is, on a state and local level, build it there. A third-party national candidate cannot win at this point. And there are very few places where a third party can even win a statewide election. You know, you got Bernie Sanders in out of Vermont. He's a senator from Vermont. I would trade every single person, you know, maybe bar two or three or a handful, in the Senate right now for Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that it's very few states in the country where you can get away with something like that. You need to build a party from the local level.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to also note is that we need to support Dennis Kucinich. I'm understanding that the Democrats are trying to get him off the take away his seat, putting four, I think there's four well-funded corporate candidates going against his seat. So
yeah, I would encourage everybody to head over to his website. I don't have it right here. Lauren, will you check that out for me?
And also, I like your voice work on Lucy, the daughter of the devil.
Oh, well, thank you, Robert. That was very kind of you.
Thanks.
Appreciate the call.
Bye.
Robert, of course, was talking about my work, my voice work on Lucy, Daughter of the Devil. It's a, what's it called? Adult Swim on Cartoon Network. Oh. All right, folks, we'll take more calls. We've got people who have been holding for a long time. I promise, Richard, I'll get to you next. 800-989-1480. 45 past the hour. Sam Cedar in for the great Mike Malloy. Back, Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. Just one short segment left, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go to the phones. Richard has been holding forever from Boca Raton, Florida, and on the internet. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Hi, Sam. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Good, just great. I wanted to first of all let me just say that I've always enjoyed your work, and you're sharp, you're clear, and you get to the point.
Oh well, thank you.
But you said something earlier this evening I want to touch on, and actually a couple of points, but one in particular. To me, the evidence is overwhelming that there's been a cover-up of 9/11. And whether it's been an inside job, whether it was let it happen on purpose or make it happen on purpose, whatever, the point is that we tend to hear, and you stated it earlier, that the hijackers came in from Afghanistan and did their work, as if it was an absolute, you know, proven fact.
These guys were obviously were 19 of them were Saudi nationals. Look, I mean, I think, you know, I agree with you that we don't know what really happened on that day, but I do believe, frankly, that Osama bin Laden, at the very least, anticipated our coming there. They killed this guy, Massoud, who was the only guy, the strongest leader of the Northern Alliance. They killed him literally a week, I think it was, before 9/11. Osama bin Laden knew we were coming. Now, I think that is the one thing that I am confident about, that there's a lot of different ways that it gets from Osama bin Laden orchestrating or planning or being or funding or whatnot this thing to any other theories. But one thing I'm certain of, that Osama bin Laden anticipated us coming to Afghanistan. So,
well,
I mean, you know, maybe you want to suggest that none of those people came from Afghanistan. It's hard for me to imagine that they didn't, but go ahead.
Yeah, let me just say this real quick. I sure don't want to get into a whole long discussion.
I'll give you another minute. Go ahead.
9/11, but you know about the 9/11 Commission. You know the Jersey Girls.
Yep.
Had many questions that remain unanswered.
Yep.
So there's definitely, let's forget about Bin Laden, Afghanistan. The fact of the matter is a lot of questions, a tremendous number of questions, whether it was
just the other day, it's being reported by a New York Times author in his book.
We knew about it 4 years ago.
Right.
And now it's coming out in the book.
Right.
We knew Zelikow there was a tremendous conflict of interest. Now a new book is out, which is only telling us we knew 4 years ago.
So yes, you're right.
Okay. I just wanted to say that, to me, it's not to say, you know, that it was definitely a bin Laden operation. You know, bin Laden has never even been on the FBI number one wanted list. He's never even appeared on there. So, and we know about all the tapes, supposedly from bin Laden, which are videos where it sure doesn't look like bin Laden. So all I'm saying is, bottom line, there are a tremendous number of questions that have been not been answered, and have, in fact, been ignored by the 9/11 Commission and by the media.
I would agree with that.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll just basically let it go with that. One other thing I want to say real quick.
Quick.
I've been very active through the years in doing an election fraud analysis, and I think that's another very, very important issue that I wish liberal talk show hosts like yourself would get into in more depth because, you know,
all right, Richard, look, let me, I'll answer it. Let me let you go, and I'll answer it when you get up.
Okay.
I mean, I think, you know, I know Randy Rhodes got very deep into this stuff. It's just not the stuff that I focus on. You know, I have a limited amount of time, and there's some stuff, and I think my personal feeling is that the fear of widespread vote changing, I think, is not commensurate with the size of the problem. I think, you know, in Florida and Ohio, we've got Secretary of States now who are addressing these things. I think we should go to paper ballots. And I think it's an issue. I think what's more of an issue, frankly, are things like caging and things like other means in which to disenfranchise people. I just don't believe that there is, you know, a 20% swing in voting nationally. Or 50%, or I just have not seen substantial evidence of it. Now maybe it's out there, maybe there's more evidence out there, and I'm not the guy to carry that torch. But I mean I just haven't seen it. And as far as you know, whether it's Bin Laden or pictures of Bin Laden or whatever, at the end of the day, we created this guy, whether he's a fiction or not, we created him. We funded them to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and we suffered blowback. And there is no doubt in my mind that there is somewhere a nexus with people between Osama bin Laden and agencies within this government, because the CIA worked with him. They used to pay him money. So there's somebody in between delivering that money. I mean, it would be foolish to think otherwise. That doesn't mean that George Bush pulled the trigger and pressed the button. Doesn't mean that Dick Cheney didn't, though. All right, we got time for one more. Well, no, we don't have it, dude. All right, Ali, I'm sorry, Jeff, Mike, Ron, Lauren. It's been a pleasure. I want to thank Mike and Kathy, Ian, Billy, Lauren. Always an honor to fill in for the great Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio at NovaMRadio.com. Everybody's very nice. You actually get a paycheck when you do this, too. Fascinating. All right, folks. Mike Malloy will be back on Monday. So long, Truth Seekers. Cedars out. I'm going.